right, it's another beautiful Thursday in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're tuned into the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network. I want to take a quick moment to thank today's sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is a beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. All right, time to kick it off on the Farm Report. We are on the line with Fred Magdoff. Fred, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great, and welcome back. Fred, you were on our show back in February, episode 68, if people want to revisit some of the stuff we talked about a little bit earlier this year. But today we brought you on the show to talk a little bit about food security and food sovereignty on a global scale. So I'm excited to tuck into this big issue. We'll kind of work our way through as best we can in the next half an hour. I thought it might be helpful to start out with a little bit of defining exactly what we mean when we say these terms that you hear a lot, like food security and food sovereignty, and just kind of set the context for our discussion today.
Sure. Well, food security is basically an individual or family issue or a community that you actually are able to access food. For the individuals. And so, as a matter of fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture used to do a survey of hunger. They now do a survey of food security. So they've abolished hunger.
With the sweep of a pen.
From a terminological point of view. And it's referred to as food security. So, are you secure in being able to get the food that you need for you and your family? Food sovereignty is really an issue on a national level, or it could be a regional level as well. But are you producing the basic foods in your country that your people eat, or are you having to depend on imports? And that's a very, very important question these days for reasons we can talk about. But a lot of countries that were food sovereign in the sense that they were basically supplying their people, at least with the basic foods. They might have been importing some foods and exporting some, but with the basic diet, that quite a few of those countries actually have abandoned that and are importing a high percentage of what their people eat. And this will cause problems, as we can discuss.
Okay.
That seems to be the distinction, the food security on the individual or family, and sovereignty on the issue, on the scale of a nation or region.
So we tend to be on the show a little New York City and New York State focused. We've talked about these issues of food security and food sovereignty with guests on the show before, and I think it's something interesting to note that even though in the U.S. we have this really overabundance of food to the point where we have this exploding kind of obesity and diabetes crisis, the issues of food security are still very real. Here within the city, where there are a lot of families, I think one in eight families is food insecure in the city. So this is an issue, not just in not just in these faraway places, but also here in the city. But I think today we want to kind of focus on things from a more global perspective and kind of talking about how there's this interaction between countries like the U.S. and maybe some of our neighbors to the south, and how our food system here or our farm bill is impacting some of those other places around the world. So, Fred, I was hoping you could kind of talk about, we hear this figure tossed around a lot that by 2050 there'll be 9 billion people in the world. I know about 2/3 of them living in cities, and you hear often that there's kind of not enough food out there to feed that many people. And how are we going to solve this impending crisis of not producing enough food? And and preventing people from, you know, being hungry across the planet. Is that a real fear? I mean, are we really in danger of like running out of food on a global scale?
I don't think so, but it means we have to be careful. I mean, right now there are 7 billion people in the world, and so approximately, and about half of those living in cities, more than half now are living in cities, and that figure that you mentioned is what is generally accepted, 9.2 billion by mid-century. So, I mean, that's a substantial increase in the amount of food that needs to be produced. On the other hand, we can see right now. Let me just go back a second, and we can come back to your question.
Sure.
But there is plenty of food produced right now, obviously within the United States, to feed all the people in the United States. So we have some 50 million people that are considered to be food insecure in the United States. With some 12 million or something like that are considered to be very severe, have very severe food insecurity, which basically means, you know, that people are skipping meals in these families on a regular basis so that others can eat within the family. And when you look at it, even on an international basis, countries that we consider to be poor, many of them have enough food within their countries, or there's certainly enough food produced worldwide, okay, even if it's not produced within their country. And so the issue then is why? Well, the question comes is why? How can this be?
You know, right.
How can you have all this food that I say and other people say, and you can just look at the numbers, and still have hunger, substantial hunger on a world basis? It's estimated by the UN that it's a billion people. That is, you know, 1/7 of the population is hungry, basically, or what they would call malnourished. So it comes down to an issue of two things. One is these people are poor. So if you have enough purchasing power, no matter where you are and whatever country of the world you are, you can buy enough food if you have the money to buy it. So there's that aspect. And the other aspect is food is considered to be just a commodity like any other commodity. It's, you know, it's no different philosophically in this sense, you know, from the systems point of view. It's no different than a car or some jewelry or a Rolex watch or a pair of shoes or whatever. It's a commodity. And if you have the money to buy that commodity, then you have what economists call effective demand. If you don't have the money to buy that commodity, well, you're just out of luck. And so food is looked at as just another commodity. Now, there is an exception to that. I mean, like in the United States, we have what used to be called the food stamp program, SNAP. You know, so there is at least a lip service given. It's not enough to eliminate the problem, but at least there's some acknowledgement that we need to help people get a sufficient supply of food. There isn't an equivalent program, you know, for cars or for, you know, other commodities.
Right, right, right.
So to a certain extent, in some countries, that's recognized, but it's not. It still goes back to that issue that it's essentially an issue of poverty, and poor people don't have this what economists call effective demand, which basically means they just don't have the money. So this is the underlying issue. I mean, you had situations. This is long before the food crisis of 2008 and the current food crisis that we're in now in 2011, which is getting to be pretty similar to what happened in 2008. Which was very severe, its effects, and we could talk about that on a global scale. But long before that, there were stories, stories from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal from 2002, 2004, from India, where there was wheat, you know, literally rotting on the docks. They were going to be exported. It was going to be exported, but it was rotting because they weren't taking good care of it, and there were people starving in the country. And so you have, even in some of the poorer countries in the world, you can have food surpluses at the same time that you have people starving. Okay.
Right.
the food surplus is going to be exported. It's going to be fed to animals. And now we have this whole other issue, of course, with biofuels. So that's one aspect of it. Another one is that the U.S. government and the Western countries, through the World Trade Organization, using the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, they developed a philosophy that was imposed, or they were encouraged to accept it, that basically said, you should get the government out of agriculture and out of food, don't support your farmers, don't buy them seed or have your own seed companies, national seed companies, don't have your own government storage facilities, and just let the free market do it all, because the free market is going to work its magic. And the reality is, this didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you had was a situation where, well, the other aspect was, of course, I mean, of the free market, is you lower the tariffs, or eliminate the tariffs on food, so that food can come from abroad, your food could go somewhere else as well. Well, the long and short of it is that many countries really lost a lot of their capacity to produce food because their farmers were displaced by cheap imports of food. And this, any of the listeners who haven't seen, are interested in this issue and haven't seen the documentary called Life and Debt, that's D-E-B-T, it's about Jamaica, and one of the themes of the documentary, this isn't the only theme, is really the destruction of Jamaican agriculture by imports from the United States. And another example, also from the Caribbean, is Haiti, where after the earthquake, Clinton, who was involved in earthquake relief efforts, I'm talking about last year.
Right, yeah.
He gave testimony in front of Congress in which he basically said he's sorry that he basically helped to encourage or force Haiti to open up their markets to rice from the United States, and it really not eliminated, but certainly had a tremendous detrimental effect on rice production in Haiti. And so that you have this problem when a earthquake like that comes along, they don't have the capacity to feed themselves. The other issue is that once you've lost the capacity to really be sovereign, if you will, produce the food that you need in your country,
mm-hmm.
when you have a spike in prices, like what's happening right now, and what happened in 2008, then you're really stuck because you're importing so much food. You have to pay the world market prices. And in a way, if you have food sovereignty, what happens on the world market can be irrelevant. You know, it doesn't have to affect your prices because you're producing it in your country for your people. And it doesn't have to be influenced by the world market price.
So we're kind of looking to pull apart these two phrases, this idea of food security, but then also food sovereignty. So thinking with regards to food sovereignty, basically a country's ability to feed itself, and food security, a family's ability to have access to food that they can afford. And so, you know, you pulled out a lot of big and kind of meaty issues that I want to tuck into a little bit more, but we're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll continue.
service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Main Course Sundays at 12 p.m. with hosts Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer. They examine issues from the interconnected worlds of agriculture, cuisine, and sustainability. They sit down with key players in the chain, from producer to consumer, farmers, distributors, chefs, activists, and journalists. The Main Course explores every important component of the eating experience: how the farmers raise their product, the distribution channels that move the product, how the chefs prepare it, and how ethics and policy affect everyone involved. Again, that's The Main Course, Sundays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, we're back. You're tuned into the Farm Report, and we are on the line with Fred Magdoff talking food security and food sovereignty on a global scale. So, Fred, I wanted to try and narrow our discussion a little bit. And, you know, you said before the break that there was kind of these big decisions made on the world stage through the, you know, IMF and the World Bank to kind of loosen the support that governments were giving their farmers and turn things into like more of an economic model. And that this has led to this kind of crisis with regards to food sovereignty, in particular for poor countries, where it has become essentially cheaper to import food than to grow food, and that has led to kind of the falling away. I'm making a jump here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the falling away of food production within that country, leaving them kind of vulnerable when these prices shift to kind of being in a worse state than they were before, because now they don't have the food growing within their own country, and they can't afford to imported, and it's, you know, it's not, the rice has to come from somewhere, the food has to come from somewhere. So what do we do? How do we kind of back up from this system that we've set up, or what are the initiatives that are happening out there to kind of address some of these problems?
Well, I think you summarized it very well and did it quicker than I did. I think food has to be treated as something different than other types of things that are produced by human beings, because it is so essential. I mean, obviously, it is essential to life. You can't say the same thing about a car. You can say it's helpful. It makes life easier. You can say all sorts of things, but it's not essential to life.
I mean, and you can't eat it.
That's right. I mean, you know, food, water, air. These are essential aspects. You know, clothing. If you're in a cold area, you have to have some protection, you know. So there are certain essentials of life, and food obviously is one of the basics. And so I think it needs to be treated differently on the world stage. First off, within each country, I think it needs to be treated differently than it is now, and then I think it needs to be treated differently on a world stage. And the way to do this is to allow countries and to encourage countries to support their farmers and to try to develop food sovereignty for themselves, that is, within each country, so they can put up a tariff if they want to against U.S. Rice or wheat or whatever it is, and then to have their farmers produce it themselves. So to me, that's one of the critical issues. The other one is, when supply and demand are close to each other, you can still have plenty of food, as we do now, on a world basis. But the supplies are tight. And when that happens, especially in this environment that we're in now, the financial environment that we're in now, speculators jump in, and they drive the prices up. And you never know how much is really due to speculators. But there's no doubt that it's happening. I mean, there's no question it's happening. So this is, I mean, if you read the financial press, this is one of the issues that they talk about, that you really should have some exposure, that's the way they put it, that your portfolio, your investments should have some exposure to commodities and to real things, not just hocus-pocus financial gimmicks, mm-hmm. but actually something real, like land or like a future contract on corn or wheat or something like that. And therefore, you have index funds, you have individual investors getting in to this game, if you will. For them, it's a game. I mean, all they're trying to do is make money. You know, they're speculating that the price is going to go up. This happens, by the way, on the local level also. This is an issue in the Philippines with regard to rice, of local hoarding, you know, by merchants who have large stocks of whatever it is, and they think the price is going to go up, so they don't sell.
Right.
So, you know, on the local level, it's hoarding, but on a national or international level, you've got the financial speculators. And this is just one of the things they speculate on. So I would, if I was able to control things...
Yes, we'll give you a magic wand for a minute.
If I had the magic wand, I would say, A, do not allow speculation in food, period. That's the end of that. And number two, do everything you can to encourage every country in the world to help their farmers to produce enough food for their own people. There may be a few countries that can't do it, but most certainly can. And I would go further than that. I mean, it's not part of our discussion. I would say this can be done by ecologically sound ways, and it should be done by ecologically sound methodologies. I'm talking about, you know, the growing, how you actually raise the food.
Right.
And I would say another thing that is, I think, essential is that we stop producing agrofuels. That is also part of the problem. Products that could be used to feed people are being used to feed cars. We can't eat the cars, as we discussed before.
Right, right.
But we are feeding cars with what was or could have been food or feed for animals. And that, in the United States, it's corn. It's made into ethanol. In Europe, they use canola to make into biodiesel, also soybeans, and they're buying a lot of palm oil from Indonesia, Malaysia, in order to convert it into biodiesel, the so-called green fuel. I mean, these so-called green fuels. Well, we can get into it, but these fuels aren't as green as they are touted to be. But there's substantial amounts of a product going that way. And so this has an effect in squeezing demand and raising prices. A third to 40%, somewhere in that range, of the U.S. corn crop over the last few years has been made into ethanol.
I remember kind of when people first started talking about this fuel source, and it was really touted as this alternative, you know, to oil, and this was what was going to really, like, you know, propel our fuel needs in the future. And you know, it seems like that argument has shifted really quickly, I think, within the community that I inhabit, and into this discussion that you're bringing up now, where you're essentially creating this competition for food and our ability to kind of produce these, you know, produce the corn or produce the palm oil isn't really there, and this isn't really kind of the way to create fuel. So what happened in that shift there? Was this just a short-sighted vision? I mean, how did so many people and things get behind this without kind of realizing all these really important spillover effects that were going to be impacting, you know, the world's ability to feed itself?
Well, first off, two things. One is, I'll get to your question, but I think it's also important for the audience to recognize that these fuels are not so environmentally sound as they seem at first blush. I'm talking about both ethanol and biodiesel. Ethanol, there are estimates that it actually produces a net gain of energy, but there are also estimates by David Pimentel and other co-workers at Cornell University that indicate you actually are using more energy to produce ethanol than you're getting out of it. You know, because it takes so much energy to produce corn, and then it takes so much energy to distill the ethanol after it's been produced by fermentation, it has to be distilled three times to get the water content down to the point it can be used as a fuel. So you have water pollution problems, you have all sorts of issues, I'm talking now of ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
And with the palm oil, what's happening is, forests are being cut down in the tropics in Asia, and with massive release of carbon dioxide from these burning of the forest and the disturbing of the forest, in order to plant the so-called green fuel, the oil palm tree that will then produce the biodiesel for Europe. But it will take an estimated 400 years to pay back all the CO2 that's been sent up into the atmosphere by the conversion of the land from the natural forest to this plantation. And you've also displaced people, so there's that as well. So to get back to your question, I'm sorry I digressed.
I think it's important to point out this kind of, we talk a lot on the show about the real cost of things and trying to figure out ways to quantify like the real cost of something so that you're able, because things are often, I think, compared as though, comparing apples to apples when really there's this whole other set of costs. And I think this is, you really demonstrated, it's like a great example of like really thinking through the issue and what are all the steps in that production and being able to put that number or that idea kind of on one side of the scale and really compare it to the alternative in a way that's a little more fair.
Also, let me just throw this out. I just did the math a couple of weeks ago. If you just take a third of the U.S. corn crop, which is approximately what's used, as I mentioned, between 33% and 40%, and say, well, what if we were to feed that to people to satisfy their basic calorie needs? Now, corn doesn't provide everything. It's not complete protein, etc. But it could supply, and it does supply, the basic calorie needs for many people. And so this corn that was going into ethanol, that is going into ethanol, could actually feed people. And just pushing a pencil, I come up with a number that would provide enough calories for 450 million people. For a year.
Wow.
That's the corn in the United States that's going to ethanol. So, not saying it would happen if we stopped doing the ethanol, because these are poor people, and again, it's an issue of having the effect of demand, but it gives you an idea of the magnitude of some of these agrofuels. But to get back to the question, how did it happen? In the United States, it happened. It was all political. It was not the environmentalists who were pushing for it, although they did get on the bandwagon, and they've jumped off the bandwagon. But initially it was ADM, Archer Daniel Midland, which is a major grain trading company, purchase and processing of grain, and CEO of the company. Really pushed this for years and years with presidents from Nixon on and Congress, Bob Dole and many other key people. And they, I don't know how this is coming through, but it sounds like interference here.
Oh, yeah, I think we got it there. The rain is just, that sky's just opened up on us, so we got a little bit of wobble there.
Yeah. So anyway, the ADM, which is a major grain trading company, really pushed this. And the head of ADM, Andreas, who was a big wheeler and dealer in political circles, and they were looking for something to do with all this grain that they had and to try to get a little more pay for it. And so they were instrumental in getting the law passed for subsidizing ethanol production, because it generally is not economic to produce it. So initially it was $1 a gallon. Now I think it's 50 cents a gallon, but there's also a 50 cent a gallon tariff on imported ethanol from Brazil, where they can produce it much cheaper from sugarcane. So I think it started off as a political issue by a giant grain trading company to try to find some way to make some more money out of the corn they had. Now, then it got into law in which now all gasoline that's sold at gas stations is supposed to have 10% ethanol, and there's the mandate to go to 15% ethanol.
Wow.
And, you know, whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know. But that is, apparently it is.
And I guess any way you cut it, you sit back and I don't know, I'm scratching my head a little bit as to the kind of how did we get here? And Fred, I'm sorry, we are out of time. I feel like I love having you on the show because we always are kind of talking about this big meaty topics and trying to kind of do them justice. I want to direct our listeners to the book that you co-edited, Agriculture and Food in Crisis, Conflict, Resistance, and Renewal. A great kind of primer on a lot of these different issues. But then also, if you just Google Fred, a lot of good stuff comes up, and we will be sure to kind of bring him back on the show to kind of continue some of these discussions that we get going. And I want to thank you for being on the show with us today, and ask people to tune in next week. We have John Amoroso, the former Cooperative Extension Director for New York City, in to talk a little bit about the work of Cornell Cooperative Extension in New York City. So join us then. And Fred, thanks again. Let's stay in touch.
Very good. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaways Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the green market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.